Hi, so welcome to Lesson 8. Today we're going to be looking at what I'm calling rules and decision making. So let's get underway. The United Nations has three main deliberative bodies. That is the General Assembly, the Security Council, and the Economic and Social Council. The Secretariat does a lot of work and sustains and maintains things. The International Court of Justice, of course, deals with justice issues. So the outcomes of these main deliberative bodies usually take the form of resolutions, decisions, protocols, treaties, conventions, and even covenants. In the end, they're all a form of agreement, intergovernmental agreements. Now, I'm going to try to keep this simple for today, and so we're going to mostly just look briefly at resolutions and decisions, as the UN uses the terms, because these are the ones that we're going to come across the most often day-to-day over at the United Nations. The Security Council is the only one whose outcomes are binding on all of the member states. The Security Council can also make simple recommendations. Well, maybe not simple, but recommendations. And these are not necessarily binding, as the term indicates. However, by the time something becomes a resolution, especially under Chapter 7, then these resolutions are binding on all member states. So back to resolutions. Now, the United Nations resolutions are formal expressions of the opinion or will of United Nations organs. So you can have resolutions of the Security Council, of the Economic and Social Council, or the General Assembly. And they generally consist of two clearly defined sections. That's a preamble and an operative part. The preamble generally presents the considerations on the basis of which action is taken, an opinion expressed, or a directive given. So that's usually the basis of it. And then the operative part states the opinion of the organ or the actions that are being requested to be taken. So that's resolutions. Now, decisions are usually used to designate still formal actions of the body, but they usually deal with non-substantive or routine matters, so procedural issues such as elections, appointments, time and place of meeting, etc., etc. So the resolutions are held to be pertaining to substantive issues of the body, and decisions just more along the lines of procedural and things that need to be done to keep everything moving along. So they're sometimes also used to record the adoption of a text representing the consensus of members of a given organ. So they're the basic two main outcomes, you could say, of the organs of the United Nations. Now, each of these deliberative bodies has their own rules and procedures. So those usually address issues of organization of the meetings, how often they'll meet, where they'll meet, the duties of the Secretariat, what they need to do to prepare for that, when they need to prepare for it, how many months in advance, things like that. The rights of the delegates, what they can do, what they cannot do, what is required of them to be considered valid delegates of that meeting. And then, of course, there are procedural motions, points of order, how the business is going to be conducted during the course of those deliberations. And then, of course, they've got the overview on voting arrangements and provisions that decisions or resolutions or the outcomes of that deliberative body become substantive. They also address the functions and the powers of the presiding officers. Now, when everything is smooth and everything is fine and everything is very pleasant, then a lot of these things are very easy to deal with. The minute there are points of contention, many times people will go back to the rules of procedure and make sure that everything is being done according to the rule. Sometimes people use the rules in their favor as strategic levers for their objectives. And so in the end, the parliamentary procedure that is outlined for each deliberative body becomes a very, very important piece. Now, rules of procedure provide structure and direction to guide deliberations and negotiation processes in formal conference settings. So Ambassador Winfried Lange, who's written much on a number of areas, especially as it pertains to the United Nations, quote, said, "Rules of procedure are the backbone of a visible and open negotiating process." And that is what is sought for the United Nations. Now, it may not always be achieved, but that's what is sought. So I'm sure that in the course of your journey through life, you may well have come across Robert's Rules of Order. It's the, you know, the preeminent parliamentary procedure that is used for conducting business in any kind of a group or association or formal organization. It might be the board of an organization. They are guidelines for how to get groups of people to work together effectively who are also endeavoring to produce outcomes, decisions, and improvement through the collaborative efforts that people make in groups and in organizations. Now, the rules of procedure at the United Nations, there are rules of procedure for the Security Council, rules of procedure for the General Assembly, and for ECOSOC. And these can be found on the website. You know, you want to go and look through them and just see the kinds of information that are in these rules of procedure. The General Assembly rules are in this location. The Security Council and the Economic and Social Council have their rules in all of these places. And we'll also have the links below for you. If the rules of procedure form the constitutive backbone for the deliberative bodies, then it's the UN Charter that actually provides the backbone structure of authority for the global constitutive process. That is, it has the power to establish or to enact that is intended to secure both minimum and optimum world order. And the UN Charter then is effectively a network of practices specialized for decision making. Now, with the mission of the United Nations to unite the nations and get all stakeholders involved in policy making, to get them taking up a shared commitment to those policies, to get them to sustain the policy decisions, it makes sense to look at which decision-making process is going to be able to do this best. Now, most of the deliberative bodies were established with a simple voting mechanism as the main form of decision-making. The history of the United Nations has shown that, to some extent, the simple voting process doesn't always quite foster the unity that is sought. The simple fact of the matter is, at the United Nations, especially in the General Assembly and in ECOSOC and all of its various committees, etc., that the decision-making process has shifted away from the one country, one vote toward that of consensus decision-making. Here, I'm not going to go deeply into consensus as a decision-making process, the pros and cons, and all of the blow-by-blow steps of this of when consensus came in and how it evolved. I don't know all of those details. And it's not so easy to find a history of the development of consensus at the United Nations. I've looked. There are merits of consensus compared with other forms of decision-making, and in particular, the simple one country, one vote process. While they are still in the rules of procedure and always that is the bottom line for how things will proceed, decision-making has evolved at the United Nations that consensus has become a major form. Now, there are, as with everything, some pros and cons for this. So it may take you some time to, you know, get a better grasp of what this consensus decision-making process is, perhaps some time to go and look up a little bit more to understand the strengths and the values of consensus decision-making. I will go into this just a little bit here, not in depth and not thoroughly by any means. Now, consensus is effectively or potentially a powerful process for bringing groups together to move forward with decisions that are inspired and effective. And this is the more altruistic perspective. It's intended to be a thoroughly cooperative form of decision making, but in reality, it's not appropriate for all situations. So, what is consensus best for? It's best when there is a shared purpose. In theory, that's the United Nations. Explicit values, well, to the extent that they're enunciated in the Charter of the United Nations, there are some levels of trust and openness to each other. There's silence on that one. And that there is enough time to work with material in depth. And it's best for bonding people together. Now, consensus relies on every person in the circle bringing their best self forward to seek that unity. But that probably doesn't always describe everything that goes on at the United Nations. Now, for consensus to work, the group does not need to all think the same or have the same opinion or support the same proposal in a unanimous voice. And that describes the United Nations very well. But what does need to be sought is a sense of meeting, an endeavor to converge, a desire to come to some kind of united perspective. What is also required is the power to listen. And the power to block should be just used as a fallback. Now, in consensus decision making, when one person clearly disagrees, they can effectively block or stop the whole decision from being made. That power to block can be misused and abused, just as anything. But in theory, blocking should be just used as a fallback. Consensus at the United Nations isn't always used in its optimal way. It doesn't always have every person in the circle bringing their best forward. There isn't always a sense of meeting and a desire to genuinely come together. And the power to block often becomes a negotiating tactic in a larger chess game of politics where the scarce resource, not the scare resource, although maybe that's true, but the scarce resource is political support. But don't get me wrong about consensus. It's not all negative. But I was endeavoring to bring up here both some of the pros and cons for consensus as a form of decision making. So now I've got some homework for you. I want you to consider this. Just say you're the one who's to be responsible for planning how to lobby the countries that are on the Committee on NGOs in ECOSOC, the ones who are pondering and either approving or denying ECOSOC status to the NGOs. Now, how would you go about it differently if you knew, A, in situation A, that all you needed to do was get a simple majority out of those 19, you needed to get 10 countries to approve you, and then you would have ECOSOC status? Or B, how differently would you go about things if, in fact, you knew that you could not afford to have one country that would stand up and ask too many questions or definitively say that they don't like your NGO? Do you think that you might need to think of a slightly different way to approach those countries? Now, just to help stimulate some of your thinking, these are some possible steps that you could do. First of all, find out who is on the committee. So this is the link to find out which of the nations that are on the NGO committee of ECOSOC. Now then you'd need to consider which of those nations might be supportive of you. Which nations do you have? Does your organization have some activity in? You might visit them and let them know that you're coming up for approval, that you have specific projects and programs that are working exceptionally well in their country, and you just want them to be aware of your NGO. You also perhaps should identify a couple of the countries that, if there are any, who may be unfavorable to your organization. Now, in the situation especially of human rights organizations, many times it's actually very difficult for them to be approved as ECOSOC organizations because quite often specific member states intentionally serve on the NGO committee as a form of protection for their own country. But then you could stop and think, well, which countries do I have good relations with who may have a relationship with that country who is potentially seen as being problematic? That is at least one way that you could begin to think about how to go out to lobby some of those countries if, in fact, you needed to make sure that there was not one country that would be prepared to stop the process of your approval. So you need to consider, why don't they support you? Is it a perception issue, or is it substantive? Do they have proof, or is it otherwise? What can you do to assure them or to assuage their concerns? Are there ways in which you can work with some of the other countries who are strong supporters of your organization to help dispel misperceptions or misunderstandings? Are you beginning to see how different your approach might be if you are going after getting enough people who are supportive of you compared to ensuring that there is nobody, no one country, willing to speak badly about you publicly? I think you can see right there you would have to have quite a different strategy. It's quite a different piece of work that needs to be done. Understanding the decision-making process is essential if you're going to make effective strategies for your particular objectives at the United Nations. So you can see from this that it's very important for you to do the research in advance as to how the decisions are being made in the particular field or area of concern that you plan on working within. This one piece of information, this one piece of research that you can do, can make an enormous difference to your planned strategies, or it can simply make the difference between going out and making your best effort, but making your best effort in completely the wrong way and really losing the opportunity to achieve your objectives. So I hope you've enjoyed today's lesson exposing this virtual secret about decision-making and what it can mean for your efforts at the United Nations. And I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.